From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, dozens of Chaldeans arrested in an ICE sweep through Metro Detroit. Advocates say deporting them to Iraq could be a death sentence.
We're following the rules of the law. And the law is very clear that people cannot be put in harm's way and shipped off to a country knowingly they're going to be persecuted.
The state takes a step closer to combining Medicaid physical and mental health services under private insurers.
As we as a state scrap to find resources for physical health and behavioral health benefits for Medicaid individuals, we've got to find a way to do more with less.
A top PR exec says Michigan State needs to move beyond saying sexual assault scandals are not acceptable.
The key question to me is, what's the game plan going forward? What will the university be doing to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again?
But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This was a traumatic, emotional weekend for the Chaldean community of Metro Detroit. Chaldeans are a Christian minority from the Middle East, mainly from Iraq, and many live in Southeast Michigan. Over the weekend, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested dozens of Chaldeans, leaving family members stunned. Yesterday, some of them lined the fence outside the U.S. Detention and Deportation Center in Detroit. That audio, courtesy of MLive. With us now is Martin Manna. He's an Iraqi-American Christian who's president of the Chaldean Community Foundation. Martin, from what you know right now, about how many people were picked up by ICE yesterday?
That number is ranging anywhere from 40 to 70. We know it's at least 40, but I would assume that it's closer to that higher number.
And many had been in this country, what, for years, even decades?
Mainly a decade. So they probably arrived to this country in the late 1960s or early 70s.
Now, most of these people who were targeted in the sweep yesterday did have past criminal convictions. Is that correct?
Yeah, there might have been a misdemeanor or a felony. So there was past criminal activity, but they've all been adjudicated.
What kinds of convictions, to your knowledge?
To give you an example, one was a minor marijuana offense. One was shoplifting. Another was an unregistered handgun. So, you know, there's quite a few of them, and many, if not most, were minor offenses.
ICE has released a statement listing crimes such as homicide and rape and aggravated assault, sex assault, weapons violations. Does that fit to what you're hearing from people?
Sure. So let's talk about that
yeah.
for a minute. Let's just assume there's about 300 members in our community that are on final order of removal. And of those 300, less than 3 to 5% would have are what we would call hardened criminals, those that are criminal sexual conduct or those involved in attempted murder or things along those lines.
Now, this term you used, final order of removal. All of the people who were arrested had that final order of removal. What does that mean?
At some point, and this is probably the best way to understand it, they all came to this country legally. They're not undocumented. They came with their families, but they came as children. And for one reason or another, the family didn't apply for their citizenship. And before they got their citizenship, they committed a crime, unfortunately. So it might have been a misdemeanor, shoplifting, or a felony, something along those lines. And once you have a record like that, you've been convicted of a crime like that, you have no path to citizenship. So then they're issued final order of removal. So the undocumented gun, for example, the unregistered gun was a crime that was committed in 1986. Here we are more than 30 years later, and that person was never removed. They are always in contact with their ICE officer. They routinely check in with them. So it's not as if raids were needed to go pick them up. They're aware of where they're at, and they are checking in with them. They're all following the law. Most, if not all of them, have become good model citizens. So the question becomes, okay, these are criminals. Why shouldn't they be sent back, right? That's what everyone keeps asking.
Yes.
Well, if we want to follow the law, there's also laws in place that protect people from being sent back to a country in which knowingly they'll be harmed or persecuted. Last week, Congress passed a resolution unanimously that genocide has been committed against Christians and other minorities in Iraq. So how could we as a country send them back when we know they're going to be put in harm's way? Who are we to give them their death sentence? They've already paid their debts to society. They did their time. So how could we now impose a death sentence against them? So if we're really truly following the law, there are laws protecting against countries willingly and knowingly sending people and putting them in harm's way.
Martin, did people have any clue this was coming?
I think, under this new administration, there was a lot more concern. You know, remember, even under President Bush, President Obama, there was more activity with ICE. But Iraq was never one of those countries that people were being deported back to. Part of the problem, too, is you really can't prove for many of them that they're even Iraqis. They came as children. You know, many of the churches in which they were born in no longer exist. I mean, we had 340 churches in Iraq just in 2003, fewer than 40 remain. Most of our community was in and around Mosul, and ISIS has destroyed all relevance to any sort of Christianity there. So that's a whole other challenge. There's really not much that could be done as far as issuing travel documents because they can't really prove they're Iraqi nationals. The only country that they really know, and they're culturally illiterate when it comes to Iraq, they don't speak Arabic. They've lived in this country, the United States, most if not almost all of their lives.
From family members that you spoke with, Martin, what did ICE officers tell people when they were taking people away? What stories are you hearing from family members?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of emotion, and ICE is just telling them, you know, we're doing our job, and this administration wants people removed. And so that the irony of this is you have a Chaldean community, and the consensus is that many Chaldeans supported this administration, mainly in Macomb and Oakland County. And unfortunately, this administration is who is deporting their loved ones.
What part of Donald Trump's message resonated with those folks who supported him?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the previous administration's unwillingness to act on the atrocities being committed against Christians and other minorities by ISIS. They thought that they were slow to react. When it came to protecting minorities, that previous administration was really good at doing that, but not when it came to Christians. And so that was one of the reasons many people were angered by the previous administration and thought that this president would be different. And, you know, there's kind of if you think back to some of the comments, the executive orders that were issued, you know, this president has talked about prioritizing minorities like Christians or protecting Christians in the Middle East. You know, on one end, they're saying that. On the other end, they're trying to deport Christians back to a country where they knowingly will be persecuted.
What do you think that support looks like today?
Well, I think people are rethinking that. Unfortunately, it's a tough scenario. I do believe that if you look at history in this country, you think of Cuba and Fidel Castro. That Cubans weren't sent back to Cuba knowingly that they would be persecuted. That there should be special consideration given for folks like this, and that's what's going to have to happen. We likely will have to file a federal lawsuit. This is going to have to be played out in the courts. And we'll see what comes of it.
Now, what about today? Do family members know where their loved ones are, and have detainees been able to communicate with families or with attorneys?
Yeah, well, you've always told them they should all have individual representation. There's a lot of emergency motions that have been filed for stay of removal. So, again, that's going to have to be played out in the court. They've moved most of these folks to Youngstown, Ohio. It's a processing center. We're hearing that there might be a plane leaving as early as the end of this week.
So, again, there's court orders being filed and legal action being taken as we speak?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the only way to protect them.
Now, do you think this sweep is over? I mean, are there more folks in the community who have these final orders of removal?
Oh, yeah. I think the sweeps are just beginning.
Why?
Because I know there's more of them, and eventually they'll get to everybody.
Any idea how many more?
It's my understanding that there could be as much as 300.
So how do you see this playing out, Martin, especially in homes all around Southeast Michigan?
Well, there's a lot of fear and anxiety that's permeating throughout the community. There's likely going to be some demonstrations and protests. But as I said before, we're following the rules of the law. And the law is very clear that people cannot be put in harm's way and shipped off to a country knowingly they're going to be persecuted. It was just last week the head of the Iraqi Shiite community, one of their most prestigious clerics, came out and said that Christians are infidels. They should either convert or leave the country or be killed. And so they've made this easy on us because we don't have to dig too deep to get the information that's needed. It is very clear that they are persecuting minorities, specifically Christians, and they should not be sent back to that country.
Martin Manna, president of the Chaldean Community Foundation. Martin, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My honor. Thanks for having me.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokesperson Khalid Walls released the statement earlier today, and I quote, "As a result of recent negotiations between the U.S. and Iraq, Iraq has recently agreed to accept a number of Iraqi nationals subject to orders of removal. As part of ICE's efforts to process the backlog of these individuals, the agency recently arrested a number of Iraqi nationals, all of whom had criminal convictions for crimes including homicide, rape, aggravated assault, kidnapping, burglary, drug trafficking, robbery, sexual assault, weapons violations, and other offenses. Each of these individuals received full and fair immigration proceedings, after which a federal immigration judge found them ineligible for any form of relief under U.S. law and ordered them removed," end quote. Walls says most of those who were arrested are being held at the Northeast Ohio Correctional Center in Youngstown, Ohio. It was Maize and Blue Night at the 71st Annual Tony Awards in New York. Alums from the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance were big winners. Benj Pasek and Justin Paul graduated in 2006. They won Tonys last night for writing the best score for Dear Evan Hansen. Quite a year for this duo, who recently won Oscars for writing the song City of Stars from La La Land. Dear Evan Hansen, by the way, won 6 Tonys in all, including Best Musical. James Earl Jones, Class of 55, won a Lifetime Achievement Tony. And the very first award of the night went to Gavin Creel for featured actor in the revival of Hello, Dolly.
But I want to dedicate this, oh my goodness, to the musical theater department at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. My education there as a young person changed my life forever. My professors, my classmates, they instilled in me an appreciation for what it is to be an artist and what it is to be lucky to be a part of this incredible community. If you're out there and you have money, and I know a lot of you in this room have a lot of it, start a scholarship. Change someone's life the way that Art and Marty Herron changed mine.
Gavin Creel graduated from Michigan in 1998. This was his third Tony nomination and his first win. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Ladies, does this sound familiar? You want to lose weight, so you begin an exercise program. But that weight loss isn't anything like you'd been hoping for. You feel bad about that, and your interest in your fitness program withers, and then you feel bad about that, too. Michelle Seeger has been examining how to break that demoralizing and unhealthy cycle in new research funded by the National Cancer Institute, looking at our attitudes towards exercise. Michelle directs the University of Michigan Sport, Health, and Activity Research and Policy Center. Always good to see you, Michelle. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what did this study dig into?
Well, what we wanted to do was this differently than most physical activity studies. We thought, how do effective marketers actually figure out how to promote or talk about a product or service? And they don't ask people about the product and service. They start with, what do people care most about? What do they want in their lives? So we started the study by looking at women's, what we call proximal goals, the things that are immediate. What is a perfect day like? What makes you feel successful on a daily basis? So we started our study having nothing to do with exercise, so we could identify what are the things that they care most about first. And then we went and started asking them questions about physical activity. What does it feel like? What do you believe about exercising? And we also collected data both among high active women and low active women, because we were interested to see if there were any differences. And what we found, which was the first thing we found, wasn't surprising.
Which was?
That the high active and low active women, they reported the same things for happiness and success. There were no differences between those two groups. The real difference came was when we started talking about exercise and physical activity. And we found real differences between how the low actives talked about and described physical activity and how the high actives, and how those things tracked on what made them feel happy and successful.
So let's go back to what they had in common. What were some of the common themes that everybody could agree on that made them, these are women we're talking about,
yes,
made them feel happy and successful?
Yes. And so, and we had a cross-section of women of mm-hmm. ethnically diverse focus groups. So we didn't just talk to one ethnic group. We talked to 3 different ethnic groups. So what everyone agreed on was that connecting with and helping others made them feel happy, feeling relaxed and free of pressure made them feel happy. Escaping their daily routine was something they talked a lot about. And the other thing that made them feel happy was participating in leisure time activities. And when you think about what the word leisure means.
Yes. Different things, doesn't it?
Well, it does mean different things. But underlying that word leisure is the idea that people are choosing themselves what they want to do, that they're choosing activities that they want to do. So that was the results for happiness. So there were really two core things that made women feel successful, and one was helping others be successful. So there's this theme of others in both. The only theme that crossed over between both categories was others and people. And the second thing that made women feel successful was achieving goals as small as checking off a list from going to the grocery store or as big as getting a professional degree.
So that translates into attitudes towards exercise. How?
Well, let's think about this for a minute. If those are the things that make women feel happy and successful, then what would you think physical activity and exercise would need to be in their lives in order for it to support instead of thwart happiness?
It should not have a sense of pressure. I'm not sure how the helping others fits in, but I'm hearing that theme.
Yes, so absolutely. One of the things we found among the low actives was that they felt very pressured by physical activity. They felt pressured about why they were doing it. There was talk of needing to lose weight, get those heavy bags off their body and not being successful doing it. There was talk of it had to be 40 minutes in high intensity and the commitment.
Because that's what we're told.
That's what we've been told.
Yeah.
And the commitment that they couldn't make. So those things undermine the very experiences that women want to feel happy. And again, that was the other difference. For women to feel happy, they talked about experiences, but success was about achievement. And on both of those components, physical activity really got the big axe because they didn't feel successful because it was too big and too long and too hard, and they didn't have the energy for doing it.
But the high active people.
There were some comments that showed, getting back to this connection theme we talked about, that when they were active, they could do it with their family. And they noticed that when they started doing it, one woman said, my kids ride their bikes and I run. I'm happier and they're happier. It's better for all of us. So that's a way that these high active women linked these things that they cared so much about with physical activity.
The others. There go the others.
There goes the others. And the other thing some high actives said was when they were active, they knew they had more energy to do these other things that they cared most about. But in contrast, the low actives talked about it as detracting and taking away from their time with family. So what we're seeing from these distinctions is that in a way, the high actives have figured out how to transcend the rules, if you will, that most people being people who are inactive, believe we still have to follow with physical activity, whereas the low actives are really still stuck. And one of the interesting things is that since 1996, in a way, the rules have, quote unquote, changed. What are our official physical activity recommendations? You don't have to sweat and talk like this to exercise. You can do a more moderate level intensity and you can accumulate it. So you don't have to do the full 40-minute commitment. It's interesting. These newer recommendations have been around for over 20 years, but because of the way we believe things and we tend to have a confirmation bias, we don't hear the new ways of doing it. So we really need to radicalize and revamp what people think physical activity means, what it has to look like, and give people permission to accumulate and do what they want, what's going to work for you.
Taking what you're telling us from your research, how do the low actives take this and translate that into something that will get folks moving?
Well, one of the most important things to do is really to toss out any rules you think there are in your brain about what physical activity needs to look like, should look like. You know, research shows that any movement is better than none. So it might not be that there's maybe an optimal dose of physical activity for cardiovascular benefits, right, to do it in that way. But if you can't do it, it doesn't matter. So let's let go of optimal doses. I mean, think about other areas of our life. There might be an optimal way to create a meal, But some days you don't have time to do it, and maybe most days, but you still got to eat. So I think we have to develop a much more flexible menu, if you will. Count everything and understand that it's truly your choice. And if you don't choose to move for the other immediate benefits, for that little burst of energy, and even taking a 2-minute walk can increase energy. So physical activity isn't what we think it is. It's actually this incredible daily treasure that if we start to look at it and pick it, it can give to us incredible immediate positivity.
What questions now do you want to answer based on this research? Where do you want to take this?
Well, this study was among women. So one of the questions is, which messages? So now that we know this, now it's time to devise some new messaging and then do some experiments and see which are the messages that really do resonate with low active women and will help them feel like, you know, this is something that I do desire.
Michelle Seeger, who directs the University of Michigan Sport, Health, and Activity Research and Policy Center. Lots to think about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Collaborative,
part of the community.
The next idea.
You need to be awake and take actions to make sure the things that matter to you and the impacts that you want to see in the world actually happen. And I feel like a lot of people don't do that.
As Detroit's fortunes rise from the ashes of bankruptcy, developers are seeing opportunity. Certainly Dan Gilbert is making an indelible mark in reshaping downtown Detroit. In the neighborhoods, we see banks and outsiders seeking opportunity. My guest today on The Next Idea wants to help Detroit residents find ways to develop their own neighborhoods. And today he has won a Night Cities Challenge Award for a program set up through his nonprofit Building Community Value Organization. Chase Cantrell is a former real estate corporate lawyer who is the founder of Building Community Value. Chase, pleasure to welcome you here to The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
You call yourself a solutionary, and I really like that word. What do you mean by that?
Well, just as it suggests, finding solutions to the complex problems that we see in Detroit. So being focused not necessarily on all of the problems that we see, if we get bogged down by that, we'll never find the solutions, but really thinking about the opportunities, thinking about all the treasure that we have in Detroit that we can leverage to really make real-world solutions.
And you left a very visible Michigan law firm to found this nonprofit that's devoted to redeveloping commercial properties in
Detroit.
That's
correct.
Why so?
Well, there are a lot of individuals who are focused on residential in the city. I think that it's a great investment for a lot of people, and it's an easy way to make money in our current market. But we have a lot of vacant commercial space in the city as well, and we need to have folks who are focused on that. You know, I drive down certain corridors. I mean, I grew up on 6 Mile or very close to it, and I drive up and down 6 Mile or Grand River or Gratiot, and there are just these beautiful buildings that need some love. So we definitely need more folks centered and concentrated on these buildings.
And I know that you've recognized building those commercial neighborhood strips.
Mm-hmm.
These are the nuts and bolts businesses
they are.
That are at the end of the street where people live.
Right.
Neighborhoods need that to thrive.
Well, they do. So, I've often talked to other developers about this. If we're not concentrating on both commercial and residential at the same time, we're not going to have neighborhoods that thrive. Folks are spending money. People are going out to, I mean, if you're in Northwest Detroit, you're going to Ferndale or Royal Oak to shop. You're going to big box stores outside of the city. And I mean, we used to have very vibrant commercial corridors where people could, you know, walk to the end of the block, like you said, to find retail, to find food and restaurants. And we need to bring that back to all of our neighborhoods in the city.
So this program you developed, Better Buildings, Better Blocks.
Yes.
What is the goal?
Well, the goal is to get more Detroiters involved in the development ecosystem. So, you know, this is not the nuts and bolts where we teach people how to put in drywall or, you know, install a window. This is teaching people about development. So how do you find a property? How do you do site selection? How do you do a pro forma, which can be complex for some people, but how do you actually price out that deal to know if it's a good investment or not? So teaching people how to find it, how to price it out, and how to find financing so that people can actually go out and do these projects.
So let's say someone approaches you and they mm-hmm. want to get involved in Better Buildings, Better Blocks, and they have an idea.
Sure.
I want to run a coffee shop.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do?
Well, I would ask them first if there's a neighborhood that they're interested in to gauge, you know, how much real property costs in that neighborhood. And I would start to run them through some of these questions. So, you know, do you have financing? Do you have a business plan? Have you ever done a development before? And if not, are you partnering with someone who understands development? it's really teamwork. Most development is not one person doing a deal. It's, you know, you have an army of people who are helping you, whether it's lawyers, title workers, contractors,
people
architects,
like
people like me. Yeah. So it's really helping people build that team. So we provide students or participants in this program a lot of resources so that they can begin to build that team for themselves.
Is this program designed to take people who really are newbies, who have not mm-hmm. done this, or does it kind of presume people have entrepreneurial experience?
So it runs the gamut. So we actually, even though you know we're announcing the grant today, we actually had our first class earlier this month, and our current class, I mean, it's very diverse. I mean, the youngest person is 22 years old, the oldest is 77. It's diversity across racial lines, gender, sexual orientation, academic experience. So we really do want people of all different backgrounds to come to the course and, you know, go back to their neighborhoods and do something positive.
So it is a specific course that lasts how long?
It's a specific course that lasts 3 months. Okay. During that 3 months, there are 6 in-class sessions with I am not the instructor, but the instructor is another active developer. His name is Dietrich Noer of the platform. And we have 6 class sessions. We have video lectures. We have a very accessible, readable textbook that we use. We have weekly office hours. So last 3 months, but, you know, there's a lot of one-on-one FaceTime.
And what's there after the class? Is there a support network for folks
yes.
once
so,
they graduate?
So what's wonderful about the funding through the Knight Foundation is that gives us the opportunity to really have these wraparound services. Once someone, you know, we have an individual or team project during the course. And, you know, a lot of that can be theoretical. You know, we have somebody, you know, find a project, you know, price it out, go through the process. But
what's a typical project when you say, for example?
Well, you know, there are people who are interested in commercial. There are some people who are interested in even smaller scale, you know, that vacant house, you know, across the street. So it runs the gamut. But let's say someone's looking at a small commercial space. You know, once they come out of this project period, we want to continue to give them support, you know, help them refine their pro formas, help them find banks that are open to lending, help them find investment. So, you know, there are definitely opportunities after the course to stay engaged.
Now, do people have to pay for this course?
Yes. So there are real estate programs all over the country, but there are none that really have the sort of collaboration that we have. But, you know, instead of paying thousands of dollars, we are only charging $100. So, We think that it's important that, you know, folks who come through the program have a little bit of skin in the game because it's a real class. I mean, there's real work that people have to do. And if they're not invested, you know, they're taking a spot of somebody else who really could have benefited from this.
What does a Detroiter who lives in a neighborhood where there could be this possible redevelopment, mm-hmm. what do they bring to the table when it comes to redeveloping that neighborhood?
Usually passion first. I mean, people are very, very passionate about placemaking. I mean, they live in the space. They really want to affect positive change along with their neighbors oftentimes. For the first class that we had this summer, we had every student come up to the front of the class and tell why they wanted to be in the course. And I told the TAs and the instructor afterwards that I was holding back a bit of emotion because really people had some salient stories about how they had seen their neighborhoods change over the past decades, how they really wanted to help bring their neighborhoods back. There are people who had bought property before, not knowing anything about the system, and who wanted to, you know a bit more so that they could do it more professionally. There were just tons of different stories. We even have an executive director of a community development corporation who's there, who's actively doing a commercial project right now, but he wants to deepen his understanding about the process. So,
who can sign up for the course?
Anyone, any resident of the city of Detroit, Hamtramck, or Highland Park. So it's not just Detroiters; it's, you know, those three cities.
And how do they reach you?
They can go to my website. It's www.bcvdetroit.org.
Which means building community value. What does winning this Knight Cities Challenge Award mean for you personally? I mean, you've had this vision. You've mm-hmm. stepped into a whole new life away from your life as a lawyer to do this. What does winning this award mean to you?
Sure. You know, I'm really active on social media. So after the first class earlier this month, I actually posted a fairly lengthy post saying that this is validation, right? This feels wonderful to know. I spent a year trying to build an organization wondering, you know, is this really having the effect that I want on real Detroiters? And first, the stories that, you know, folks in the class shared with us and, you know, the validation from the Knight Foundation. It's like, no, we're really moving in the right direction. We're having the effect that I want to have. And, you know, I just want to take it to scale.
What do you hope, if you and I are sitting here 5 years from now mm-hmm. talking, what do you hope will be the long term impact of better buildings, better blocks?
One, I hope that there are more Black and brown developers in the pipeline. I mean, a lot of the profiles of those who are doing development currently are largely white, largely male. middle age or older. So, you know, getting more young people involved, getting more people of color involved. And I would like to see catalyst projects in these neighborhoods. So, you know, I was telling someone earlier today that it only really takes one or two commercial projects in a neighborhood before things can take off. So I would love to see some of these, you know, neighborhood developers doing that work.
Chase Cantrell, founder of Building Community Value and a brand new Night Cities Challenge Award winner for his program, Better Buildings, Better Blocks. Thanks so much for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, a top public relations exec gives his view on how Michigan State University has been handling the accusations of sexual assault against a sports doctor and four football players. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Plans to change Michigan's mental health system would take a step forward under a budget plan for the Department of Health and Human Services moving through the legislature. It calls for a pilot program in Kent County that would integrate Medicaid, mental, and physical health services under private insurers. Mental health advocacy groups say that would compromise the quality of care. Backers say it'll make the system more efficient. Here with us is Dominic Pallone. He's executive director of the Michigan Association of Health Plans. Dominic, what are your thoughts on the DHHS budget proposed last week with regards to integrating physical and mental health services?
Well, we're very happy with the proposal that came out last week, and it still has some more steps to go in the process, obviously, but we're happy with the language that was put in, as you mentioned, to integrate behavioral and physical health. And really, this is the legislature now wanting to move forward with pilots aimed at fully integrating behavioral and physical health. And when I say fully, I mean integrating behavioral and physical health, both the clinical side of physical and behavioral health and the financial side as well.
And why is that something that you're happy about? Why is that a good thing for Michigan?
We're very confident that there's an opportunity here to improve physical and behavioral health outcomes for the Medicaid enrollees. And we believe we can maximize efficiencies in the system and minimize unnecessary costs.
So there'll be several pilot projects over the next year exploring ways to actually better integrate care. What do you see as the priorities for these pilot projects?
You know, our goals here, at least the pilots that will involve Medicaid health plans, licensed Medicaid health plans in the state, our goals is we need to show and document that we can indeed improve those physical and behavioral health outcomes, and then document any of the efficiencies on the administrative side that we're able to identify and push additional resources ultimately into the behavioral health support system that exists today.
Dominic, as you know, there's quite a bit of concern among consumers and family members. Namely, they're fearing there won't be as much transparency in the system as well as access to the decision makers. How will the health plans allow for input from the people who receive these mental health services and their family members?
As licensed health insurers in the state of Michigan, and that any plan that holds a contract with the state of Michigan to do Medicaid has to be licensed in the state, which means they need to be resident of the state of Michigan. They need to have people on the ground here in the state. They need to have a governing board. A minimum of one-third of that representation on the board needs to come from enrollees. So at a very minimum, state law, and this is in the state insurance code, it's been there for a number of years now, at a minimum, health plans need to have board representation that includes enrollees. We also have a path here where plans, and again, this is in the state insurance code, where plans can create an advisory council to advise that board. We fully expect that our plans will be creating advisory councils that involve enrollees within this grouping of care, so behavioral health individuals and their representatives, so parents, guardians, et cetera, that may be representing the interests of the individuals. On top of that, there's always the traditional path in which to appeal any claim, both internal within the plan and external, involving the state through the Medicaid mediation channels or through what's known as the PRIRA Act or the Private Right of Individual Review Act, which involves our state Department of Insurance and Financial Services oversight and control over claims, whether or not a claim is approved or denied. If it's denied, that person can appeal to DIFS if they so choose.
Dominic, as you know, there are so many family members, parents, or siblings of people who receive behavioral mental health services in Michigan who are going to be affected and don't want private health plans to have more control of the mental health system. I mean, we've had parents say that they hope that their child dies before they do because they fear no one will be there to take care of their child. How do you assuage these deep-seated fears?
Yeah, I don't know that I can, quite honestly. I think change is difficult, and I certainly can sympathize with some of the parents' beliefs and fear for the unknown. But I can say this. The state, when looking at how to provide services, both physical and behavioral health services for Medicaid individuals, the state has to figure out the best way to purchase health coverage. And it's doing it today by purchasing it through private, some for-profit, some nonprofit health plans on the physical health side. And it's purchasing it through quasi-governmental entities, these prepaid inpatient health plans today on the behavioral health side. What we're proposing in the pilots is that the state make a better purchase approach and that they procure these services through predominantly through health plans and therefore better align the physical and the behavioral and the pharmacy benefit for these individuals.
If you take kind of that message and boil it down to like one heartfelt message to these concerned parents, what would it be?
I would say that this is something that, you know, the state has to govern its resources wisely. Unfortunately, as we look at the federal government's actions currently, we'll see what's yet to come from Congress, but it appears as though there will be a pretty substantial cost shift to the state of Michigan. As we, as a state, scrap to find resources for physical health and behavioral health benefits for Medicaid individuals, we've got to find a way to do more with less. And I think this is one way to do it. We've seen other states go in this direction. Michigan will not be the first. And we're confident that we can improve physical and behavioral health outcomes, and more importantly, that the savings found from these improved health outcomes, from improved administrative efficiencies, will have to be reinvested back into services and supports for individuals that are at risk of mental illness or have an intellectual or developmental disability or a substance use disorder. We see this as a way to improve health outcomes and push more money into supports and services for these individuals.
Dominic Pallone, Executive Director of the Michigan Association of Health Plans. Dominic, thanks for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Michigan State University sports physician Larry Nassar, accused of sexually preying on athletes for decades, now in jail, facing federal and state charges. His accusers say they tried to bring their complaints to MSU for years. Nassar was only fired last fall. Four Spartan football players charged with criminal sexual conduct just since January. MSU is an institution in crisis. So how should an organization like Michigan State deal with mounting crisis? We welcome Jeff Caponegro of Caponegro Public Relations, and he's author of the book, The Crisis Counselor. Jeff, welcome.
Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
Great. And we should begin by telling everyone that you were a chairman of the board for Central Michigan University. You've also served 4 years on the Walsh College Board. You get the challenges a university faces.
Yeah, I sure do. Universities have a lot of moving pieces, and they have a lot of stakeholder groups, students and their parents and administration, you know, the faculty, deans, donors, trustees, alumni, the community, political officials, and so on and so forth. There are an awful lot of stakeholders out there, audiences, publics, whatever you'd like to call it, who are interested in the success of the institution and expect to be communicated with in an appropriate way. They have a lot of questions and a lot of concerns. They feel like that they have some ownership in a way. They expect to have answers. So when something like the situation at Michigan State University crops up, you know, they have a lot of questions, and I'm not sure all of them have been answered yet.
That's what I'm wondering. What do you make of the way MSU's handled all this so far?
I see these as sort of two different situations in a way. And when I look at crisis situations, I often will look at them like they're easier to manage if an institution, a company, corporation, nonprofit, whatever it may be, university, hospital, whatever, were they victimized in a way? Or the more difficult crises to handle are those that maybe somebody dropped the ball on something.
maybe this should have been avoided. This could have been prevented if they had their act together, if they knew what they were doing, if they had all the processes and procedures in place that they really should have, if they had anticipated these things. And those are more difficult to handle. And I think you've got a little bit of a mixed bag of both of these in the gymnastics doctor Nassar situation and the three football players. But the fact of the matter is now you have a pattern. And this is what you want to try to avoid. You want to avoid patterns in crises. Isolated incidents are one thing. I always look at them like a tumor. If you can isolate the tumor and cut it out and extract it from the organization, that's one thing. But if all of a sudden that tumor is spreading, that's when it becomes really lethal. And that's what you try to avoid. So, you know, they've got their hands full. And I think what you're seeing is them trying to communicate that they're looking into the situation with the Jones Day investigation and so on, and they are communicating their compassion for the victims. You know, this does not represent who they are. I think all of that is good. The questions that I think are still out there, what could have been done to avoid this from happening so that we can learn from it? And what are we doing to ensure that this won't happen again? And, you know, you haven't heard a lot of that. Maybe, number one, they don't know. And maybe number two, sort of the jury's still out in what exactly they should do. But if I were at the board chair or if I were at Michigan State University, I'd be asking the question of what are the best practices in this area? What are some of the best universities in the country or the world doing in some of these areas to prevent these things from occurring?
Let's take a listen. President Luana K. Simon hasn't really given any interviews about the Larry Nassar investigation or the incidents involving the football players. She did release a video May 10th. Here's a quick clip.
This is a difficult time, and it's been troubling for many, particularly for Spartans, as they see media stories about investigations related to sexual assault at MSU. The seriousness of the charges requires the most deliberate investigations possible.
Jeff, what about this strategy of President Simons releasing a video and staying away from interviews?
I don't like that strategy. I know that part of that may be, obviously, the attorneys may be talking to her about that and counseling her to have a more controlled message. It may be her own comfort level or discomfort level in putting herself out front on it. I'm always a big believer because I've trained thousands of clients over the years on preparing for interviews and preparing for that. I'm a big believer in thinking about the questions that people have in mind. You can come up with a response to almost anything. And, you know, obviously, if you've got to make sure that it doesn't cross over certain lines and you want to make sure that they're all factually correct. But I'm a big believer that you can train just about anyone, including a college president, a university president like President Simon, to be out there because it's so important to show that this issue is so very critically important to us that I'm getting out front on it and I am willing to talk about it. And no, we don't have all the answers, but you can be assured that, you know, this is of the highest priority for us.
What about the strategy of this message? It sounds like it's been difficult because of the media investigations.
You know, I've done hundreds and hundreds of crisis situations over my 35-plus year career. Almost every one of them have some sort of a legal aspect to them, potential litigation or real existing litigation. Attorneys are involved. That oftentimes will turn into a very carefully cloaked message. Let's not say anything that could come back to bite us at some point. So there's a little bit of that. I do find it interesting that President Simon has sort of tried to make this in a sort of isolated sports issue. And I sort of question that. She is the steward of the brand, if you will. Part of the responsibility of the president is to protect the brand. The Michigan State brand is being tarnished through these crises. Part of her job is to sort of reinforce some of those same key points. And in a way that makes it look like she's very open and transparent and accessible and not running from anything, not afraid to address anything, because people are watching. Okay, what is Athletic Director Hollis saying about this? What's football coach D'Antonio saying?
Well, and to that point, let's take a quick listen because we've got that too. We're going to start by listening to Mark Hollis, who spoke publicly on Tuesday.
I offer my deepest compassion to the young woman and her family. Sexual assault has no place on our campus, on any college campus. In fact, there is no culture where it's acceptable for one person to abuse another.
And here's Coach D'Antonio speaking of his anger and about kicking these players off the team.
You know, you have to look at certain things at times, I think, and you ask yourself, well, did they break the law? Or, you know, that's to be discovered, I guess, at a later time. But you have to ask yourself about the morals involved in this. And from my perspective, the morals were not where they needed to be. This thing that's occurred is very, very difficult. As I said earlier, I didn't even want to talk about football for the last 6 months because of this situation. And we had refrained from doing that because of the seriousness of this.
They're in tough places because they're trying to run athletic programs, yet having to set that aside. How do you think they did in those statements?
Well, I think they did fine for what they were. And again, they may feel like that's all they can say at this point. First of all, obviously, everyone's innocent until proven guilty. The key question to me is, what's the game plan going forward? What will the university be doing to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again, or at least to try to do the best it can to prevent it? Now, obviously, when monitoring student-athletes, you can't monitor them 24 hours a day, and there will be issues. But what are they doing in terms of some of the character issues and other vulnerabilities that may come up? Speaking of vulnerabilities, you know, you mentioned my book. In my book, I had a 7-step process to effectively prepare for and manage a crisis situation. And the first step is identifying vulnerabilities and then to try to prevent the vulnerabilities from happening. So when you look at the vulnerabilities in this case and you say, okay, perhaps they were never identified as potential vulnerabilities in the first place, or if they were, not enough was done about that to try to prevent that from becoming a problem or a crisis at some point. And that's what I think needs to be done. I'd love to hear at some point, these are the 5 steps we're taking to do what we can. These are the best practices that we know are out there, some of which we really should have been doing. You know, we wish that we had. But now, in terms of looking at today and into the future, these are the linear steps that we are taking to help ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again.
Jeff, and briefly, it's as we wrap up here, it's hard not to think of other scandals at universities, you know, Penn State, Baylor. How bad do you think MSU's situation is here?
As in all crises, they're all sort of different in a way. It is not to the point where Penn State's was, where things happened with coaching staff on campus that were clearly seen by people and perhaps even by some other coaches. The Dr. Nasser situation has some similarities. Whether or not that story has been completely told yet, who knows? We don't really know how all of this will unfold over time, but Michigan State University has had some serious crisis situations here. Once you're sort of out on the plank, you've used up your isolated crises that have now turned into somewhat of a pattern. And if a pattern continues, that's where it'll be extremely difficult to try to work your way out of. The essence of a brand is, how does it make you feel when you think about Michigan State University, and what does Michigan State University stand for? Those are things that if you're the president or work there or an alum or a student or whoever, you obviously want those to be good, positive feelings and not something like, oh, that's the university that is going through such and such right now.
Jeff Caponegro of Caponegro Public Relations, his book, The Crisis Counselor, on the subject of crisis management. Jeff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Petulana Ali, and Claire Bryan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.